quick housekeeping matter while we're doing the message this morning. One of the things that we want to do kind of in our continuing effort to improve our children's ministry is in our nurseries during service time. We're operating off of a rotation list right now that's a bit outdated. Yeah, elementary kids' aides are dismissed to go to junior worship. I should have mentioned that first thing. We want to update that list, so I'm going to pass around a sign-up sheet, and this is for anybody that would be willing to spend one Sunday a month, either in our baby nursery or our toddler nursery. If we get enough people, I think it'd be great. Maybe it's only once every couple of months that you need to do this, and this is for adults, this is for teens, because, you know, we can have a helper in there each time. But if you're interested in helping in one of those nurseries during service time, just put your name down. I'll start it over here. When it gets to the back, send it this way. And guys, feel free to sign up. Man, at my last church, one of our best nursery guys was a guy by the name of Frank. And the babies just love Frank. So we always could use some Franks in the service as well. Well, we have all had plans that have gone horribly wrong. Now, husbands and wives, no pointing fingers here. But there are times when our best intentions, our best efforts, and our best plans combine to create complete and total disaster. And that's not even to mention our worst intentions, our worst efforts, and our worst plans. Now, if you know what Pinterest is, you know... It's a website that you can go to for a lot of creative and wonderful ideas. And a lot of ladies especially like to go to Pinterest to get that creative spark going. And they see something on Pinterest and they think, oh, that's a great idea. I can do that too. Doesn't always work out like that. I got a few examples. Show the first picture, Wyatt. All right, Cookie Monster cupcakes. Sure to be the hit of every kid's birthday party. But this was the end result. There's a plan gone horribly wrong. Okay, next picture. Supermodel in the sunset, flinging her wet hair back. What young lady wouldn't like to create that image? But here's what happened. Good plan gone wrong. Next picture. All right, simple craft project. You take some crayons, you stick them to a board, you stick it in the oven, the colors all melt and run down, and it creates this real pretty little art project. But it doesn't always go the way you think it will. That's how it would look like if I did it right there. And last one, perfect baby picture for this time of year. You take your little pumpkin, stick her in the pumpkin. Grandma's going to love it. Everybody's going to love the picture except for, well, the baby. Like, get me out of this gooey mess. If only such disasters were limited to Pinterest. Unfortunately, we all have our share of good ideas gone bad, our plans that have gone off the rails, and if we could, we would take them back. But in James chapter 4, verses 13 through 17, our Lord's brother says that the worst is when we make plans without first seeking God's will. Now, last week in the first half of James chapter 4, we talked about what happens when we make our own wants and desires the most important thing. It creates fights and quarrels among us. Well, James is still building on this idea of what happens when we put our wants first. And what he says is that when we make our desires most important, not only are we putting ourselves in front of other people, but we're putting ourselves in front of God. And we're saying that what I want is more important than what God wants. And when we do that, what we're doing is we're putting our faith back in the box. And we are not living out what we believe. And the problem with this, James says, is that our plans rarely work out the way that we think they will. Our best laid plans, James says, are merely vapor trails if we aren't putting God first in our lives. He says, now listen, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money, while you do not even know what will happen tomorrow, what is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes. All such boasting is evil, he writes. Now, our culture praises the self-sufficient, the self-determined. We are told to chase our dreams, to follow our hearts, and to do what we want, and to answer to no one but ourselves. And we have bought into this philosophy, which was so eloquently stated by the poet William Ernest Henley in his poem Invictus, with this triumphant line: it matters not how straight the gate or how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. That's the attitude of our culture. I make my own plans. I chart my own course. I can do what I want, because it is my life, it is my body, I'm the one in charge. And even as Christians, we stumble into this way of thinking. We plan our lives and we chart our course as though our will is the only thing that matters. We choose our college and we build our careers based on what we want. We date and we marry based on what we want. We make our decisions in the home and as parents based on what we want. Now, it's not surprising to me when people in the world make plans without considering God. I mean, it's the world. But it's tragic when Christians live as though God doesn't exist. It's what Pastor Craig Groeschel of Life Church calls Christian atheism. It's when you believe and you know that God is real, but you live and act as though he isn't there. And that's what so many of us as Christians do. We act like we know exactly where our lives are going. We act like we know what's right around the next bend, when the truth is we have no clue, and our GPS is saying, turn around, turn around. And James tells us in our text that this is extremely foolish, and that God should always be at the center of our plans. So I want to talk for just a minute about why it is so foolish to make plans without God being at the center. Now, James doesn't use the word foolish here, but he takes on that tone of a parent talking to a child who's just done something boneheadedly stupid. All right? Now, I'm sure none of your kids have ever... But those first words, now listen, take on a rather sharp tone in the Greek. It is the tone of a mother who is talking to her child. Now you listen here, mister. Now you listen here, miss. Some of you moms have this down pat. You can do this really well. That's the tone that James is taking here. And why is he so concerned? Well, apparently it's because there are some in his church that are making these huge plans. And we're going to go to this city, and we're going to carry on business, we're going to make a lot of money, and we're going to do this, and I'm going to invest this in the stock market, and I'm going to, you know. And they're never even considering what it is that God might want to do with their lives. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Now let me be very clear here, and this will become more apparent as we get in the text. James isn't against doing business. He's not against making money. He's not against building a career. But James is saying that these things cannot become the all-consuming, self-assured directive of our lives. James is against charting the course of our lives without God being the GPS. God needs to be the very first consideration in all of our plans at home and at work and in the church. Not the final overlooked consideration. And when you look at the decisions and plans that you make in your life, and as you consider all the factors that weigh into how you will decide something, and as you list those factors out, the pros and the cons, where does God fall in that list? Is he up there number one? Or is he down there 10, 11, 12? Does he even make the list at all? James is saying he needs to be first on the list, because if he isn't, it's foolishness. Look at verse 14. It lays out several reasons very quick why planning without God is so foolish. Why? You don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. So let me give you just three quick reasons why planning without God is foolish. Number one, because life is uncertain. You do not even know what will happen tomorrow. Now let me ask you a question. How many of you last week, your weeks went exactly according to plan? Gene, did your week go according to plan last week? No, not at all. Every day, just about, something unplanned and unexpected happens. And a lot of times, these are major things. They could change your whole day, your whole week, maybe even your whole life. You see, in reality, your best plans, your best laid plans, are really nothing more than your best guess. Something could happen later today that will totally rearrange your plans for tomorrow. Could totally rearrange your whole week. They could mess up your whole month. Maybe redefine your whole year. Maybe even change the rest of your life. Something that happens later today that wasn't even on your radar screen when you woke up. Now, should our plans be based on what for us is just our best guess? Or should they be based on an all-knowing God who knows tomorrow even better than you know yesterday? Life isn't just uncertain, though. James says it is frail. Our lives are so fragile and delicate. And this is one of the reasons why life is so uncertain. James asks, what is your life? You are just, well, maybe not even a mist. There we go. You are just a mist. The word he uses here actually could be used for all sorts of things. You go out into the crisp, cold morning, you blow your breath in the air, and for just a moment, you think, ooh, it's cold out here. So you go in and you pour yourself a hot cup of coffee. And you can see that steam rising off the top of that cup. It could be a cloud, a vapor, a mist. Something that is there for just a moment. And James is saying that your life, that's it. Those are your plans. Your dreams, just a mist, there one moment and gone the next. Yet we like to think that it's so much more than that. And this is especially tempting for those of you that are younger. When we're young, we think we're indestructible. We think life will last forever. I mean, I remember as a teenager, high school seemed to go on forever. College seemed to be a really long time. But I'm at a stage of life now where it's just going by really, really quick. And there's something about life that strips away the facade that we have when we're younger. You think you're in good health, and then you go to the doctor for something you think's probably just a little deal, and then And then you hear something about, it's malignant. It's inoperable. Or you're going to have to change how you live. You have a good job. You think your career path is on a good trajectory. But then your company loses its biggest client, and downsizing happens. Or maybe the government passes some new crippling regulations that put you out of business, or your business partner pulls out, or you think you're all set for retirement. You've invested wisely. You're well diversified, and you're set. Back in 2008, last time the market really crashed, I was ministering in Grove, and Grove is a huge retirement area. It's full of people who spent their whole lives working to build up this nest egg, and they go and buy their dream house on the lake, Grand Lake. They get their spot on the lake, and they plan on living their last 20, 30 years of life living out that dream. But it was interesting to see what had happened. When the bottom fell out of the market, all of these people lost half of everything they were worth. And all of a sudden, their income was cut in half. And so we had all of these people that were in their 70s, their 80s, and they're going back to work. They're having to do things to make ends meet. So life is uncertain, he says. Life is frail. And thirdly, he says, planning without God is foolish because life is brief. And it all goes back to this. If you're a mist, you're there for one moment and then gone. He says, you are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. A couple years ago, I read about the death of Jiroman Kimura. This story stuck out to me because he was the last living person that was born in the 1800s. Mr. Kimura was born April 19th, 1897. His career was a postman, and he died in 2014 in a hospital bed at the ripe old age of 116. Now, 116, that sounds like a long time, doesn't it? That's an old man. But like I said earlier, I'm at that stage of life where life is moving more quickly now. I'm past the halfway point to 80, and I'll tell you this, the second half is moving a whole lot more quickly than the first half. And those of you who are older will like, yeah, it is. And it's like I said earlier, it doesn't last forever. And I'm realizing very quickly, 116 isn't really that long of a time at all. Psalm verse 9, chapter 90, verse 10 says, our days may come to 70 years or 80 if our strength endures, yet the best of them are but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away. And my wife and I were joking earlier, this is not one of the verses you will ever find embroidered on a pillow. Nobody ever claims Psalm 90, verse 10 is their life verse. But our lives would be dramatically different if we lived with this sober reality somewhere, at least in the back of our minds. And I think maybe this morning that James wrote this, he probably was reading Psalm 90 in his morning devotions. Because he's making the same point here. Life is uncertain, but death is not. George Bernard Shaw once observed, the statistics on death are quite impressive. One out of one people die. Now you would think, the fact that not only is death certain, but that it could happen at any moment would cause people to give their life some serious consideration and that they would examine their lives with sober judgment, but we don't. We just go through life as though it's going to just keep on going on. We go through life as though we will never have to give an account. That's why Jesus warned us in Matthew 25, be on the alert then, for you do not know the day nor the hour. The end could come at any moment. Even the longest, richest, fullest life is over in a flash. And sometimes it's over much more quickly than that. I met Gary and Betty at 1 o'clock in the morning. I got in a phone call. It was after midnight. It was from a family that had visited our church only twice. I barely knew their names. But they called me because they had a neighbor, and their neighbor's son had just died. And they used to have a church, but they quit going to church years ago. And the pastor that was there at that their old church now was a new guy. They didn't know him. And so they said, hey, we knew you'd be happy to talk to him. I said, great. So here I'm getting up middle of the night, changing into clothes, and I'm driving over to meet this family for the very first time on the worst night of their lives. Their 21-year-old son had stepped in front of an 8,000-ton freight train. Well, this family, up until that moment, had it all. Dad was an executive at a major corporation. They lived in a dream house in a fantastic neighborhood. They had a son and a daughter. They both had been good students. The daughter was up at the University of Chicago doing really well. The son was a star on his college's track team. But after the recent breakup of a girlfriend, he'd suddenly found life not worth living. And all at once, Gary and Betty had to face just how uncertain, frail, and brief life is. Every hope, every dream, every plan they had come crashing down on them that night. And it was the first time in years that they turned on their GPS. Not their global positioning system, but their God positioning system. And over the next few months, Gary and Betty would become good friends, and they would slowly begin to put their life back together. But this time, with God at the center of their plans. You see, going through life without a GPS, James says, is boastful arrogance. He says in verse 16, as it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes. All such boasting is evil. When we make plans without God, we are setting ourselves up above God, as though we're more important than God, as though we know more than God. And he says that's arrogant. And the word that's used here is actually a word that the ancient Greeks used to refer to the ancient equivalent of a snake oil salesman. These were traveling hucksters who would sell their wares. They would sell these so-called miracle cures, these feats of wonder. And they would promise all sorts of things, but the claims were empty and hollow. They couldn't do any of these things, but they would offer them to you for the right price. And so the Greeks and the Romans began to use this word to refer to all sorts of braggarts. And James is saying, that's what we do when we make plans without God. Who needs God? I do what I want. I know better than he does. But he says it's an empty promise. There's nothing behind it. But I can do what I want. I can accomplish anything I set my mind to. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. How arrogant of us. On June 11th, 2001, Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, was executed. And his last words, he chose for his last words, William Ernest Henley's poem, Invictus. And the last words that he spoke on this planet were these: I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. How arrogant and how foolish. Now, as I said before, James isn't against making plans. He isn't against preparing for the future. He isn't even against making plans to make money. In the Old Testament, Joseph is praised because he took Egypt's 7 years of plenty to prepare for the 7 years of famine. And in Proverbs chapter 6, verses 6 through 8, we are urged to observe the ways of the ant and how the ant prepares for the winter. In Proverbs 13, 16, it says, a wise man thinks ahead, a fool doesn't, and even brags about it. And there's other proverbs that talk about planning with wisdom, planning with counsel. Even Jesus praised our ability to count the cost of a project ahead of time so that we would be sure to complete it. So James isn't telling us to not have plans. I've known a few Christians over the years who kind of take these words and they twist them, and oh, you should have no plans at all. You should just go through life trusting God, and then the Spirit's going to guide you. That's not what James is saying. One of the primary ways that God provides for us is when we use wisdom to make wise plans and wise preparations. What he is saying, though, is that to be wise plans, to be wise preparations, God must be at the center of those things. That God must be your GPS. And so, I forgot to take something out of my box last week and nobody caught it. But I apologize. But this week, I have my GPS. Little Garmin here. These things have changed how we travel, haven't they? Can't go anywhere without, you know, either taking your GPS or your phone and, you know, telling you where to go. Imagine how our lives would be different if we made every decision as though God were our GPS. You know, because if I'm going to someplace I've never been before, you know, I'm always kind of keeping one eye on, is this the right turn? Is this the right direction? What if I just went through every day? It's like, Lord, is this the right decision? Is this the way for me to go? How that might change my life. God needs to be the first consideration in all of our plans. Look at verse 15. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. So you see, we still make plans, but we always submit them first to the will of God. We always take our plans and our decisions and see if they line up with what God wants. And so as we're making plans in our lives, it's not enough to ask, does this make financial sense? Does this make sense for our family? Is this the right thing to do for my career? Is this the right thing to do? From those perspectives, we always need to ask, does this make spiritual sense? If I follow down this course, does it keep me in line with following Jesus? Let me just give you some practical areas where we need to be looking at our GPS. First of all, in our home lives, where I live, is there a Bible-believing, Bible-teaching, New Testament church within a relatively close distance? I've known Christians over the years who go build or buy their dream home, but they never ever once consider the location of a good church to where they live. Well, and it turns out the church is too far away, so they come less and less, and before you know it, they quit coming altogether. Will buying this house, this car, this TV, this boat, this fill in the blank, whatever it is, will it allow us to still honor God with our finances? In parenting, if I enroll my kids in these activities, what is the cost spiritually? I'm amazed at families that, you know, we sign up our kids for extracurricular activities, and sometimes the price is a high price. It starts pulling them out of church all the time. Pulls them out of youth group all the time. I remember when I was a teenager, I was my sophomore year in high school, and I wanted to go get a job. And my dad said, that's great. I think, you know, working, making some money is a good thing, but you will be at church on Sunday morning and you'll be at youth group on Wednesday night. If your boss doesn't understand that, I'll go talk to him. If he still doesn't understand, you'll quit the job. My parents just laid down that rule right from the get-go. Yet I'm amazed at how often we allow our kids to be involved in activities that pull them out of spiritual activities. And so often what I've seen is these kids go off to college, and after 4 years of college, they've dropped out of church completely. And then I'm in somebody's living room, or they're in my office, and I've got anguished parents saying, I don't know what happened. This isn't how I raised them. And you know what I want to say? Yes, it is. You spent there are years in junior high and high school teaching them that sports is more important than God, that working is more important than God, and guess what? They've grown up and they've lived out what you've taught them. will sending my child to this college or university undermine the spiritual foundation we've spent 18 years building? This one's kind of fresh with us, since we have a daughter that just went off to college. But I have long been amazed at how we as Christian families will spend $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a year to have a university somewhere systematically undo what we've spent 18 years building. And so as you make those decisions about where to go to school and what university to go to, please make sure that a part of those decisions are how it will affect your spiritual life. Is there a good church near the school you want to go to? Is there a good Christian ministry? A good student ministry? Those things can make all of the difference in a young person's life. Can I honor God? And can I honor my commitments as a husband and father or as a wife and mother if I take this job? Will taking this job force me to compromise my biblical values? Will it force me to put my faith back in the box? Just some of the considerations we need to keep in mind. As we conclude this morning, I just want to give you some closing questions and then a good place to start, because what I'm talking about here is a big deal. This isn't the kind of thing that you're going to go out and change this just in one day. Question number one, what is God revealing to you about the way you've been living your life? Is God at the center of your plans? Or have you been living and acting as though God isn't there? Number two, what is God revealing to you about how much time you have left and what He wants to do with it, and what He wants you to do with it? Number three, this is a question that you've got to ask God, that you need to ask the Holy Spirit yourself. What is God calling you to do specifically? And what do you specifically intend to do about it? I think a lot of Sundays we walk out of those doors with some good intentions. Oh, that was a good idea. Maybe I should do a little bit more about that. But we never give ourselves something specific to do. So what do you specifically intend to do? Where do you start? Where do you start to kind of rearrange your life in such a big way? Let me give you three things here real quick. Number one, begin where a young boy named Samuel began. A long time ago, he heard God's voice calling to him in the night. And so he says, "Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening." It just begins with that spirit of openness and willingness to listen. And some of you are at a place in your life right now where you need to just say those words, "Speak, Lord, for your servant is willing to listen. I'm ready to put you first, God. I don't know what to do yet. I don't know where to go, but I'm willing to put you at the heart of my plans." Number two, begin by asking God to burn eternity into your heart. "For we're a mist that appears for just a little while and then vanishes." And we make these decisions just kind of based on the moment, based on what feels good at the time, based on what seems like it'll work out for right now. What we're missing is the long view, something based on not something that's there for a moment and then disappears. Only one life, and soon will be passed. Only what is done for Christ will last. Ecclesiastes 3:11 says that God has set eternity in the human heart. And in a culture that's focused only on the here and the now, we need to be people who always have one eye on eternity. Ask God to burn eternity into your heart. Number three, commit right now to making every plan conditional upon these two words, "Lord willing." Lord willing. Lord, I'd like to do this. I would hope to accomplish that. I'd like to go here. I'd like to build this. But Lord, just like Jesus prayed in the garden, my will, but your will be done. So you make your plans, but you make them knowing, God, if you got to totally rearrange this, if your calendar, if your schedule looks completely different, then do it. Make me fall in line with you. As we draw to a close today, there are some of you here that have some plans and purposes in your heart that you need to leave at the foot of the cross. There are some of you that are wrestling with some pretty big decisions right now. And maybe before you go any further, I shouldn't even say maybe, before you go any further in those plans and decisions, you need to go to the Lord and say, Lord, what is your will? What do you want to accomplish through me, with me, in me? What do you have me to do? Where do you want me to go? So as we stand and sing this song of invitation and commitment, let right now be a time that you start putting God first in your plans. Don't say, well, I'll do it later after I leave, and no. Let it begin right now. Please be standing as